Southwest 1163.
Southwest 10, the wind's 1507, runway 26 Frank. Let's see
it. Pick up 26 Frank, Southwest 10.
United 2416, Las Vegas Air, runway 26, main traffic on the 6th runway.
Carbell at the
runway 26. Star, Roger, radar contact, clear.
When it comes to chasing your dream, they say it's not the destination, but the journey. Pilot Krista Atwood is on the journey of a lifetime, chasing her dream from destination to destination through the skies. From her humble beginnings as a refugee to taking the controls of an A320, Krista is breaking down barriers in a male-dominated industry. Her story shows us that when it comes to dreams, not even the sky is the limit. She now dreams of passing her passion on to the next generation.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of C4 Podcast, C4 Southeast Asian Athlete Achievement Through Adversity. Now, while our guest may not be an athlete, she sure has gone against the grain and overcome. So these are the types of stories that we'd love to share and have guests come on. If you haven't already, please like, follow, share. Our Facebook is C4 Podcast. We also run the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. That's on Facebook. And then on Instagram, we are Lao American Sports. So without further ado, well, my name is Coach Andika. If I haven't said that already, but you guys probably heard me say that if you've been watching some of our episodes. Without further ado, I will switch it over to my co-host, John Messina, who will introduce our guest.
Yeah, we are excited today to have Krista Atwood with us. Krista, like Co said, you're not an athlete, but we took an interest in your story because as we've interviewed a lot of people, it came down to a couple things, the accomplished athletes, people following a dream and typically going against the grain and doing something different and taking a risk and pursuing their passion. And you've absolutely done that in your career as a pilot. So we're excited to hear about that, hoping it will inspire others to do the same and pursue their dreams. So in these interviews, we always like to start at the beginning. Your family and you came over from Laos after the secret war. Why don't you start at the beginning, tell a little bit about your immigration experience and coming to America?
Yeah, sure. It was just my mom and dad and my brother, younger brother and I, and we came here in the early 80s. So I was about 4 years old, 4 or 5, and my brother was still a baby. And it was the standard story that you hear all over from our families and friends. And, you know, we crossed over the river into Thailand and found refuge in a camp and lived there for several months or so until we were authorized to come to the US and meet up with the rest of the family. I don't remember much of the event, you know. My mom's told me stories of it, and it sounds kind of pretty neat. And she tells me how the kids were, and it happening in the middle darkness of the night, so you wouldn't get caught. So, yeah.
Yeah, and specifically, your family is Thai Dom, I believe.
That is our ethnic, yes, our ethnic group and background, yes. So when we first immigrated to the U.S., we went to Iowa, which happens to be fairly large in that group of Laos people. So we still have a lot of family up there, out there.
Yeah, that so actually. Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to ask, so was it easy making friends when you arrived in the States at that age of what, 3, 4, you said?
4 or 5. I mean, I don't really remember very much. I think it was just, you just get started, you go to school and you have your sponsor family help set your parents up with work, for them to work and set the kids up with school. And, you use the families because nobody could afford that childcare. You know, parents had to work. So they're working double shift, night shifts. And then the most important thing was just make sure the kids get enrolled in school. And I think growing up in the later years in middle school and so forth, when you become more aware of the picking, of kids bullying you because you look different or your English isn't as great as theirs. So
what age did you experience that you didn't experience that at 4 or 5, or you said later on?
I didn't really remember that at that age, but I think once middle school, late elementary school, you know, maybe 4th, 5th grade or so, when you start to have more memories and think back, you know, kids were always calling you funny names and because you didn't look like them.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, and we would go to ESL classes. I mean, even though at that age, your language skills anyways is starting to build, your English skills, you're starting to get strong on it. But, you know, they're making fun of you because you had to go to ESL class for a couple hours or whatever.
That was tough in the Midwest, you know. Well, you got to remember the snow, right? I mean, your first experience with snow?
Yeah, I do. Not so much. I think for the kids, it was just more fun.
Yeah.
Right? But I mean, I'm sure for the adults, it was a huge shocker coming.
Yeah.
You know, they're adults. And I think that's one of the reasons why my parents left Florida, or I mean, left Iowa. They live in Florida now. Mm-hmm. But it was a short time there, but they got overwhelmed with the weather and the snow, and they wanted to find other types of jobs. And there were family members down in Florida already. So it's like, all right, let's go see, find some jobs and better weather. So now it's like living in Laos to them, weather-wise.
Definitely very similar.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we had our last interview with Linda Tsai Vongchon, and she mentioned the governor of Iowa, Robert Ray, and I looked him up afterwards. And apparently he had allowed a large group of Thai Domp to settle as a group, where most refugees, like my wife's family, was spread out all over. And that's how a lot of the Thai Domp ended up in Iowa. He kind of sponsored them all to come to Iowa. But of course, now people have dispersed and you guys left and went down to Florida and found other things. Well, so tell us a little bit about your teenage years growing up and then how you ended up at Emory-Riddle, one of the aeronautical, you know, schools in the nation, one of the top aeronautical schools in the nation.
Yeah. So teenage years was, it was rough because you're still trying to find your place, your typical teenage things. You want to do things like your friends do, and you have parents who just don't really get it. Mm-hmm. In every aspect of everything. They just don't get it. They're busy working. They're busy saving money. They're working standard labor, minimal English type jobs just to make ends meet. I remember asking my mom if I can go to like a New Kids on the Block concert because that was the group that was in at the time, right? We're aging ourselves. And she asked me how much the concert was. And I was like, oh, I think it's like $25. And for back then, you know, $25 was a significant. She's like, we don't have $25 to go spend for you to go see some music concert. She's like, do you know how long it takes me to earn that kind of money? I'm like, wow, okay. I guess I'll just watch them on TV then. And just trying to go and do things like your American friends in high school. You know, having sleepovers. Sleepovers didn't exist. It's like, why do you want to go sleep over at somebody else's house? We don't know them. Being the girl, you were very protected, overly protected, very, very overly protected. Couldn't go out anywhere. You know, there was, my parents had to chauffeur me everywhere. You know, you couldn't go in anybody's house and hang out at your friend's house. Yeah, that's how high school, you know, yeah, middle school, high school years were like. And it was very, you were the girl, you had a certain type of attitude that you're supposed to have, a certain properness with being Laos. It was very, very strict, a certain way to dress, to sit. And you wanted to respect that because they're your parents, but at the same time, you don't understand it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel that as a male, I mean, we could get away with a little bit more. I mean, we could be rebellious. So I
right. And my brother, you know, he got away with so much, and he was younger than me. And I was like, well, why are you letting him do this? He's younger. And the standard answer was because he was a boy. It's like, oh gosh, whatever. So, you know, and leading up to what, you know, John asking, you know, what inspired me to want to go down the career path that I went down is because I felt the only way for me to really do it was to force myself to get an education so I can actually go into the world and say, Mom and Dad, I'm going to college now. And I'm not going to go near home because I need to really get out and find what else there is besides this little Laos community that we have in our hometown growing up. So when I applied to, you know, everybody in school was always saying, you know, junior year of high school, they're like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I never really had an idea about what I wanted to be. But the reason why our parents moved here was so that way they can provide a better quality of life and education opportunities for us. So hanging out with your school friends and everybody's like going into law school or wanting to be a doctor or whatever profession that's out there. And you get all these pamphlets being sent to you by the universities, by the military branches, reaching out to kids. And that's when I kind of really started to think about what I was going to do professionally, because we didn't have anything mentorship growing up professionally. It was just your parents work. They work everyday jobs and they're just trying to get by. So I started to look at different colleges around the country. All I knew is that I didn't want to go to college near home. And that was going to be my ticket out. And they couldn't say no, because saying no would mean not allowing her to go on with her career and her life and be successful. So it was always like, why can't you just go to school nearby? So-and-so, so-and-so is going to this school just up the street. Why can't you just go do and be what so-and-so is doing? You know, she's going to financing school down the street, the community college. And they're going to study finance or business. And I'm like, what the heck is finance and business? What's marketing? You know, you're 17 years old, somebody's asking you, these, like, what kind of job is financing or marketing? Or various other careers. And I don't know where exactly my thrill and my yearning for excitement and uniqueness started. Because it was always like, wow, you're doing something so different than what culturally, genderly, that most people do. So I'll stop talking for just a second.
I definitely understand so-and-so hearing about, oh, I heard about so many so-and-sos. And my path wasn't education. It was, I wanted to be a bodybuilder. So that was, they were against it the whole time. And, you know, especially my mother. But
I think, you know, the hardest part is always that was one of the things that bugged me the most growing up, was why did it matter so much about what everybody else thought of our family and your family? And I think it's a cultural thing that because your cousins and your aunts and uncles, you know, you have to get approval from everybody because our culture is so close knit like that. And if you don't get approval from them, you're just like, it's just not right. You know, you have to do what the family tells you to do. And that's just the way it is.
It's always about pride.
Yes. It's Yeah.
Well, Co, I did everything your parents wanted you to do, right? I went to engineering school. I got a job at a good company and married a nice Lao girl. So... But you went your own.
Yeah, you would have fit in with my family then. We should have like traded places or something.
Yep, for sure. So tell us a little bit about your time at Emory Riddle, what you did there, and then how you kind of evolved that into your career, Christy.
Yeah. So just going back, I mean, I applied to Emory Riddle not as a flight school major initially. It wasn't even anything in my prospects when I was considering careers, I actually applied to them as an aeronautical engineer major. So for some reason, I had this fascination with aeronautics and aviation and engineering, and everyone always said, see, John knows what I mean. Let's do engineering. It seems to be the standard, right? But I didn't want to just do like any kind of engineering. I wanted it to be something really unique. So when I started applying for classes or signing up for classes, that's when I realized that the university offered a flight school program. And you see all these other really neat pamphlets about, hey, we train airline pilots and you can travel the world and you know, what have you. So I was like, man, that sounds really, really cool. Of course, I had no idea whatsoever what I was getting myself into at all. No mentorships growing up, just based on what you read and what you see. So I started my freshman year, and then I started flight training right into it in their full-time flight program. And that's one of the many ways to go about, you know, getting your pilot's licenses. There's other ways to do it, but that was the only way that I knew how to do it back in the days, because I had already been accepted into the university. And it was my parents found out when I told them that this is what I wanted to do. My mom cried, and I don't even remember what my dad, you know, what he was thinking. And I think my mom cried more so because she saw the dollar signs that were involved. That was a big deal. And the fear, because Laos people, for some reason, we constantly live in some kind of fear, or our parents' generation. And the question was, once the news got out and they started telling friends and families that this is what our daughter is trying to do with herself, it's like, what, isn't she afraid to die? Oh my God, that sounds so dangerous. You know, I was like, oh no, I was like, but only boys do that. And I think having been in my career as long as I have now, it's not just a Krista from Laos story, it's just a woman in this business story that all the women in my business have kind of gotten that reaction at one point or another, especially if they weren't exposed to it as young girls with fathers as mentors or other family members as mentors. And that was very much the case. It's like, she wants to do what? And a lot of them were even so confused when they're like, yeah, she wants to become a pilot and work with the airlines. And like, oh, she's going to be a hostess. You know, they're like, did you not just put it all together? It's like, no, I don't want to, you know, be a hostess or a flight attendant in the back. I'm actually going to fly this thing. And that's something I'm learning to do. And when they found out about that, they're just like, you know, oh my God, that a lot of the folks in our culture and in our community down where I grew up, it's very close knit. Everybody knew everybody in the Laos community here. So, I mean, word got out and they were all like, that's fantastic and wonderful. And I spent my late teenage years and college years and being introduced as, you know, she's learning to be a pilot. And that's the pride that Ko talked about. So finally, there's that sense of pride, but I had to really force it out of my folks because they couldn't say no, just, you know. But I had to go and choose the most expensive profession to learn to get into, because it's not economical. It's just as much as going to law school or med school, if not more, with different risks that folks in our background don't know about, because a lot of kids who even go into med school, at least there's somebody who's already gone into that program becoming doctors and lawyers. But I don't think, you know, knowing anybody who wanted to become an airline pilot was something that other Laos people in America were aware of. And that's what I was talking to you guys, like, I want to meet another Laos pilot in America. So if you guys know him, give me a call.
Yeah, we don't know of one, male or female. I don't know.
It's actually interesting. I did meet a male in my old company years back, and I don't remember his name. But we did We did meet briefly. We never flew together though. And that was the only one since. But you know, this is a very big industry. There's a lot of other Asian profession, Asians in this business in this country, but a majority of the ones I run into are Chinese or Japanese.
Yeah,
I mean, sure. You definitely had a point when you said, you know, our parents came to give us a better life, you know, and I think in a way with what you're doing, you are kind of opening up the door for future Laotian, Southeast Asians to like, yes, they have someone to look up to that has done it. You did the most difficult part of like you said, you didn't have a mentor. No one had done it before.
Right.
So you took the biggest step. And I think now for the future, you know, someone who would want to, you know, go into aviation, have you to look up to consult, ask questions.
I mean, when I was, you know, going through flight school, it was rough. It was extremely rough. There were a lot of naysayers. I went to a university that was extremely prominent in the business. A lot of white males were the majority of folks that got accepted or applied and went to the university for obvious reasons. I'd be in a classroom of 30, 40 other people, and I was the only female in the class. We're all sitting there learning the basics of principles of flight and what have you. And it had been that way throughout my whole entire school years. I would be the only girl in the class. Occasionally, maybe once, we'd find another woman in the class, and she'd be on the far end of the room. And even today, when I go through my classes with my job, there'd be maybe one or two other women. I think more so, and the numbers have gone up since I first started, that's for sure. But 20 years ago, it was, you know, and there was a really terrible thing back in the days, but when you get told that you are the token hire or the token acceptance, and you don't want to, you're sick and tired of hearing it. So it makes you feel like you have to work a lot harder than everybody else to prove that you're there because you know and you learn and you're just as smart as the rest of everybody else in here. I mean, a lot of naysayers, but despite all of that, I figured out how to get my way through. I asked questions. I studied hard, you know, and graduated and got my first job as a flight instructor, teaching other people how to fly airplanes. That was a lot of fun. And from there on, it just kind of progressed through the years, and 9/11 happened, and a lot of bad things happened there with the industry. And then most recently, COVID, there was a lot of issues with that of whether or not we'd still have jobs as well. But I've been through a lot, and I would love to mentor other folks, you know, despite the race or, you know, the ethnicity, you know.
Tell us about your first experience on the plane, like the very first time, you know, you're being trained and you're sitting in the cockpit.
Yeah, I was lost. You know, I spent one of the things that they tell you to do before you start flying is to take a couple flights and sit in the back and watch other people do it. So that way, you know, you can learn from them. And I did that. And then the first time I did it, I mean, it's been so long ago, but I probably had no idea what the heck I was doing. And because I was competing, so to speak, with folks who have been exposed to this as a child, there's so many stories of to other aviators, how did you get involved with this? Oh, my dad was in the military, or my dad worked for United, and things like that. And I didn't have that story. I didn't have a dad who was already in this business. And that's a lot about how children become what they become is because their parents are showing them these things. So I guess it's a little different. I have a son who this is what he only knows now. he already knows what he wants to be, and he's at 4 years old when he was four. Looking back at it, I was like, okay, my son can say that now that he had somebody to mentor him, whether or not he chooses it, you know, it's up to him later on. I always felt behind in flight school because I didn't have those inspirations growing up. So I really had to figure it out on my own. And there was a time when things got so hard after my freshman year that I thought about, maybe this isn't for me. But I says like, no, I can't stop this now. It's already started. And I think there's a lot of other women also in my career who at one point also felt very similar things, because we just get a lot of slack from the guys for some reason. And it's unfortunate because it shouldn't be that way. But I think times have changed now, and more people are, you know, our culture, our society in America has also changed as well. So looking back at the job from when I first started and to what it is now, I'm excited to see how it's progressed in the last couple decades, but we've still got a long way to go for bringing more women into the cockpit. How I look at it is there's been a lot of young girls here in the Lao community where I live, and their parents love to tell them that this is what I do. Their daughters, and their daughters are teenagers and what have you. And a lot of them just don't think that they can do it. I just kind of shrug my shoulders and like, that's just what you're saying to yourself. So if that's what, you know, you shouldn't believe it, but I don't know why there's not more girls interested in this job. And I think it's sad.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a fear of flying, right? Yes. Like male and female, right? You just like, either it's not going to bother you or it really bothers you. Like, you know, there are people that, I mean, I get nervous while flying, you know, the takeoff and the landing, right? And it's just right. Like,
no, yeah. Well, in the beginning, yes, absolutely. It's nervous. You know, I think now that I've been doing it for so long, it's second nature. I don't even think about it. But it's funny because I'm actually afraid of heights. You won't find me standing on the edge of a building looking down 100 stories or 50 floors or even four floors. Like, no, I'll stay back behind, you know, further away from the ledge.
That's interesting.
But, you know, in the end of the day, it's because it's control. It's when you're... Mm-hmm. flying the airplane and you know what you're doing, you know what's happening, you're in control. But when you're strapped to a bungee cord or standing on the edge of a building, you're like, there's no control. And I think that's the main fear, is when you're not aware and there's no control is what causes a lot of the fear.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit, because to those of us civilians, it looks like a really exciting job. You're flying to all these cool places. I'm sure it's exhausting, but tell us a little bit about some of the cool places you've been, some of the great stories on the road.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've been doing it on and off for quite a long time. And that was one of the reasons in the very, very beginning when I was learning how to fly. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to travel the world. And I'm like, what is a better way to do it than flying these airplanes to take me to the places, right? In the beginning of the career, I did most of my routes have been in America and just in and out of small cities, flying little smaller jets and turboprops, in and out of Pittsburgh all day and smaller cities that were serviced by commuter jets at the days. You spend a lot of nights alone in a hotel, so it gets really lonely at times, but it makes you feel more happy when you come home and refreshed. And that feeling has stayed throughout the whole entire, my whole entire career. Some of the most exciting things that I did was actually getting a chance to go overseas. And I sent you guys some of the pictures when I got to go out and fly in Guam for a little bit. And when I got a chance to go to Guam, we were flying, doing a lot of things in and out of Asia and the Pacific out of there. So I just thought it was great for me, being an Asian woman, getting a chance to represent my career flying in and out of Asia, and hoping that if I saw more Asians by going to Asia, I'll actually maybe find another woman in my career. not always the case, because what ends up happening is in Asia, they actually bring in Western pilots to fly for some of the companies. But I think some of the greatest places that I've been has been in a small little plane, not as an airliner, just going up and flying a small plane. I took my husband, we flew, took a small plane up from Guam to Tinian. So if anybody ever knows about that part of the world, Tinian is where one of the planes that left to go drop the nuclear bomb in Hawaii, or onto, I'm sorry, Japan. So there's a nice memorial there that talks about World War I. Well, one of the very few ways, there's no way to get to Tinian except to get there by military aircraft, or to fly into Guam and then take a charter into Tinian. So we got on a little Cessna 172, just him and I, and we flew 100 miles, nothing but ocean. So that was kind of interesting. We had little tiny life jackets in the plane and various other things in case the worst case scenario happens. You laugh about it as it's happening, as you're packing your stuff, but nothing happened. I was pretty confident. But to him, that was a really cool thing for him to be able to do, because he was really into World War II history and some of the things that the military service did did at the time at the island and the history of the island. So that was a really neat experience. And some of the neat places that we went to in Asia, for some reason, the places in Asia just kind of really, with my job and being able to go out there, was been the most exciting. You know, I get to say that the best thing about my job is going to work where people vacation.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I know you also fly some big planes, right? A320s, mm-hmm. others. What are some of the big planes that you've flown that people might recognize or have flown on?
Yeah. When I first started out, one of the first commercial jobs I had was flying a turboprop and a Saab 340, mostly in and out of the Northeast. And then I transitioned to 50-seat, regional jets. So I have several thousand hours in those. And then from there on, I also went and flew the 737, Boeing 737. I did that. That was mostly the Guam operations that we were doing that out of. Most recently now, I now fly the Airbus 320 for a company here in the U.S. So
describe the size, like for our listeners and viewers.
Oh.
Like a 737, everybody hears about the Boeing, right? Or yeah. the jumbo jet, right? So to me, that's all 747, 737. what's like a 320 bus? Like how would that compare?
The 737 I flew was configured with 150 seats. So that's about standard seating capacity. The Airbus 320 is also a standard seating capacity of 150 seats, anywhere up to over 220 seats, depending on the configuration. 321 and the Airbus 320 and the Airbus 321 are in the same family. So if you're qualified The 321 is just a longer version. It's got a longer fuselage. Fuselage meaning body, the body. They just stretched it out by like 20 feet or something like that to accommodate more passengers. But from the front and the cockpit, everything looks the same from a 320 versus a 321.
Which is the one where, like, I think it's got the Boeing where, like, you know how most noses or most tops just are like that. Yeah. This one kind of goes up.
Yeah.
Is that like is that seating for more passengers or what is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the Boeing 747. So okay. It's a double decker. It's got the hump on the top because there's seats on the top. That's usually where the first class seats are. And you know, when I started the business, I'm like, oh man, it'd be great to fly a 747. And I think every kid going into this business always dreams of the biggest jet that's out there right now is the Airbus A340 or the Boeing Dreamliner or something like that. And as I man, one point in my career, it'd be great to fly those bigger planes, but I guess once you get to a point where you're comfortable in your quality of life, it doesn't even really matter what's behind the door and how far it goes back. You just come home. I like to say it's a job, just like any other job out there. I come home. We have a good life. I just don't do it Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. That's the beauty of this job is that I'm actually more home more often most recently in the last 2 years than I've ever been in my career. Probably because I've been at my company for a little bit and I live close to my home base. So, you know, the schedule, it's not Monday through Friday. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week. And you're gone a lot, but you can also be home a lot too if you just want to fly a schedule that just takes you out to some city and then can bring you right back home the same night. So as a mom now, that's what I love to do. I love to just go out early in the morning, get the, you know, 5 or 6 a.m. flight departure, and then come right back and bring another load of people right back to my hometown, to our home base. And then I'm done by 3 o'clock. Do that 3 times a week and life is good. Sometimes I'll just go out for one night. So those are the best. I go out for one night and I come home the next day and I'm not missing so many events. I've been at my company long enough. I can usually get the weekends off, but it's not always the case. In the very, very beginning, you pay your dues.
Yeah.
You are going to be gone a lot. You're going to be missing your family. You're going to feel alone. But those events make you stronger as you progress up into your career. And now, you know, you can get weekends off, you can get holidays off, because folks are like, oh, aren't you, you know, you're gone all Christmas and Thanksgiving. It's like, actually, I've never worked a Christmas and a Thanksgiving in almost 5 or so years.
That's great. Well, you know, what advice would you have for those young people that are interested in becoming a pilot or some similar dream?
Reach out. There's a lot of, I'm glad that you asked this question. There are a lot of peer groups now for this business. There's AOPA, I forgot what that stands for, because there's a lot of acronyms in aviation, more so than most, I think. AOPA is a small is an organization for aircraft owners. Oh, Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. They're a great resource to go to if you want to get your foot through the door. They've got a lot of things online now. I think that's probably one of the great things. When I was going through, there was no internet. So you couldn't go online and find a lot of information. So you can go there. You can go to EAA, which is Experimental Aviation, something else with the A. And they kind of gear towards smaller aircraft, experimental ownership of aircraft, and learning programs. There's also groups for women and minorities as well. Now there's things like Women in Aviation Organization. They're a really huge group all over the country. There's as well as the 99s. The 99s was a group of eight women, and I think there were like 99 women or something like that, or 99 Squadron or something. That's where the name comes from. So there's the 99s, and they've got all kinds of information out there available online. And even going out and first, just going to your small little airport, general aviation airport, because that's where I learned to fly. Even though I went to Embry-Riddle, I did some of my training at general aviation airport back home on the side. And talking and just walking up there and say, I want to learn how to fly. And there's usually a flight instructor in there. They'll show you some of the small Cessnas or Pipers or whatever training airplanes they had. I did it, you know, through the university. You can always go to Embry-Riddle's website and look at the programs that they offer. There's a lot of other aviation universities out there as well that are very, that have high alkaloids, like Purdue, Auburn, North Dakota University. All these places have degrees that you can get along with flight training programs. But one of the, I mean, anybody, my neighbor wants to go up and fly, or, you know, if my neighbor asked me this question, go to the airport up the street and go find a flight instructor and do a 30-minute discovery flight. And they'll take you up in a little Cessna and just buzz around the ground, 1,000 feet above the ground, and see how that sensation feels. And from there on, you can talk to an instructor who can mentor you even further.
Excellent. That's great advice. We appreciate that. Krista, we really appreciate you coming on today. It's been a great discussion. Co, anything else for Krista?
I got a question. I mean, I think our viewers would appreciate too, is how do you deal with jet lag? I mean, is that something you get used to?
It's hard. Yes, it's really hard. It's been more hard as I get older, obviously. Fortunately, the kind of flying that I do, we don't go through many time zones. Okay. I just do east and west coast. Sometimes it's hard to 3 hours. Yeah. But when we get to our layover city, we just go to the hotel, close the blinds, and you try and get to rest as much as you can. I don't, you know, you can meditate if you're into that kind of stuff. I try not to take any supplements, melatonin or things like that, because even though they're okay to take, I personally choose not to. Caffeine really helps as well. Sometimes it doesn't help as well either. Most recently, I've been doing a lot of red eyes. Everybody knows what that is. Mm-hmm. And it's a pilot's worst nightmare, you know, flying the late night flight someplace and then doing the middle of the night flight back from the West Coast and 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're just, and it's hard to sleep to get the rest that you need prior to reporting for work, because it's hard. And I don't know how people who work the night shift do what they do, but there's a lot of night shift with what I do too. And we try to keep those for the young guys who have a little bit more stamina.
I used to do third shift as a truck driver, and and I had two little ones, and I don't know, I think I had consumed a lot of caffeine at that time. Yep. And it's funny you mentioned the token Asian, because I was in a small company where I was the only Asian or Laotian truck driver in the company. And I totally mm-hmm. understand what you mean by how it made you feel. It's like, you know, I just, like, I'm not going to apologize for, you know, like, for me doing, you know, what I do. It's just like, right. But people were very, you know, they never said anything to your face, right? But there's always those comments that you hear about. And
I think a lot of Laos people can relate that. And you know, even though we are Asian, our being Laos, versus being other Asians in America, or some of the like Cambodian or even Thai. It's a little more unique than being Japanese American or Chinese American, because those individuals are coming from very prominent countries and backgrounds already, for the most part, if you're going to stereotype that. You know, that there was always that, oh, you're Asian, so you must be really, really good at this and have rich parents who can, you know, really give you the boost. You know, America's like, no, it's not that type of Asian. So, and then you tell people, and you guys know too, it's like, oh, I'm from Laos, and half the time you don't even know if the other person even knows where that is. And it's still like that. Yeah, 2020, and people still ask, where is that? I'm like, it's 2020.
I always got to explain that it's between Thailand and Vietnam.
Yeah, right.
So. Yeah, for sure.
That's what inspired John and I to create the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame, is to bring awareness that there are some great, athletes, individuals, and the podcast, again, just sharing the story of adversity. You're right. You're very right about fear and how just our parents. My mom didn't know any other way to, deter me except by fear. Everything was fear-based. Yeah. And then that over time, it really messed with my confidence and my self-esteem as I got older. I mean, and I got into bodybuilding where I would win shows, big shows, and I still didn't have the confidence in myself. And I, you can see that when you looked at my physique, but inside it was, I still have this fear of people, like this anxiety, I think John knows. And it's like, just because you're, it's what, unfortunately, it's what, it's what my mother, she installed in me at such a young age was fear, you can't do this, or the pride thing, or what are they going to say? And why can't you be like this guy or that guy? And it really made me doubt myself for the longest time.
Right. And it's just what they know. It's the only thing that they knew also. And the other hard part is when you succeed and, you've succeeded winning all of, in your job or your competitions, they don't understand how to accept that winning that you just accept, they don't know how to respond to it, because sometimes deep down in the bottom, you wonder if they're thinking that it's really not good enough. You tried the best that you can and you just won this huge trophy or whatever. And they are just like, they don't know their pride, but there's always that little tiny bit in them, and they'll tell it to you too. And it's like typical Lao style to tell it to you.
Well, it was like bodybuilding. When I was an amateur, you just competed. You don't receive money. That's the difference between amateur and pro. Right. So it's like, I would win. But then, like, did you get any money?
Because it's always something.
Trophy. I got this big trophy and it says first place on it. Like, can you just be proud of me?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's every Lao parent, because they are, but they don't know how to really express it. Yeah. And as we get older,
But unfortunately, it's our turn to show our kids and to say to them that you can do anything you want, right? Yeah. You can do it. I believe in you. And I think that would have made a world of difference. And I think in both our lives, right? I mean, just like, we believe in you.
And I'm wondering if that's the American way now. And we spend so much time in this culture, in this country, that, that's the norm. So now we can express those expressions to our kids and the younger folks that, geez, you guys never really said that you were proud of us, but you were proud, but you never really knew how to express it very well.
They expressed it easier to other people. Like, yeah, right? They'll say it to somebody else, right, behind your back, right? But right, they won't say it to your face.
Absolutely.
John, do you understand what we're talking about?
No, I do. Of course, okay. I didn't live it, different culture, but I've been around it for too many decades now that I get it. Yeah.
He sees it. Yes. My husband has a hard time, too, understanding, because he tries to, analyze my parents. And mm-hmm. my only advice is just, they're louse. Just
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say. Don't try to figure it out.
Yeah, for
sure.
It'll
drive you nuts if you do.
Right. Right.
Question was, yeah, how do they feel about it, you know, after all these years, you know, have you got your parents' approval, or how do they feel about it?
Well, in the beginning, you know, they were ecstatic and excited. They accepted it because they had to. And when I went through the struggles of flight training in school, they were always trying to talk me out of it, mm-hmm. one way or another, in small little bits. But I think that was one of the reasons that kept me pushing forward. The more people said, try to talk me out of it, of maybe flying isn't for you. And then that's when I said, no, I'm not going to let them tell me that. Mm-hmm. So after I'd been in it for so many years now, and they were terrified during 9/11. Anytime they heard a plane crash, I'd get a phone call. I'm like, oh my God, I'm on the other side of the country or whatever. It's not even my company. It's not even the plane I fly, whatever. You guys are paranoid, fear, as you mentioned. And it took them a really long time to accept it. I stopped flying after I had my son for several years. So they were like, maybe she's, you know, figured it out. This is what she wants to do. But I went back into it as soon as after he was old enough, my son was kind of old enough, I went back to flying. But now that they see the way that it is, that I'm able to manage our family, and them being closer to me and realizing that this is actually working out, it just took them a really, really long time. I think for me to provide them with a grandkid, have they accepted it? And now that they've seen how successful I am, we're stable in many different ways. I've got a great quality of life. I live close to them. I live close to where I'm based. And I'm with a stable company flying a pretty darn cool aircraft. They're like, this is what she's been doing now. It's taken them a couple decades. But I think probably more so because they're getting older too, and aging, and saying, we're not going to be around much longer. So why are we need to accept what she's done and realize that the kids will be okay. I think that's maybe what it is. Our now that we're adults, we're going to be okay. And that they left us in a good place for when they are gone. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably has a lot to do with why they're being more accepting.
Great.
You mentioned one last question. You mentioned being the token Asian, and what? Tell us about what type of like comments or remarks like would you get from coworkers or you know like other social.
Sometimes they try to make themselves feel better, I think. Probably by saying that she only got hired on or succeeded and gotten this far because she's so unique and we need somebody that is a minority or a woman. So we're going to let the standards be a little different. And I refuse to ever see that. And I would try and say something about it. I think that's probably what's caused my character to be as strong as I have and not deal with a lot of the BS that's involved with it. I don't think of it that way anymore because I think I'm a little bit more confident in myself.
Yeah.
And what I've acquired in my position, and I've been doing this long enough to know that that's not the case anymore. But people still joke about it just out of fun. You know, you go to a party or whatever. But yeah, it doesn't bother.
I definitely think you've come a long way, especially from, you know, you're telling us about your, you know, years growing up and just, you know, everything was fear-based, you know, from your mother and just like, you know, not having a mentor. I mean, I think that that's awesome for what you've, you know, for what you accomplish.
Yeah.
Well, Krista, this was a great interview. We appreciate all your time.
Thank you. Thank you for reaching out to me, and I'm glad that I was able to share my story.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for coming on, and definitely this is what the podcast is about, is really sharing and then just giving hope and inspiration to, you know, hopefully the next generation of Lao Americans. So I think your story definitely tells that, with all that you had to, you know, with all that you had to deal with and overcome. So
right, absolutely, yep. Okay.
All right, John, you want to say any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, thanks everybody for listening. Like Ko said, follow us, leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, any of those platforms. We really would appreciate that. Follow us on the YouTube channel as well, Lao American Sports, and we'll see you on the next episode. Thanks everybody.
Bye.
The C4 podcast is brought to you by the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. Visit us on the web at laoamericansports.com. Celebrating the first, inspiring the next.